This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline across the top of the page, Dormant Developments to Get New Lives. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a dateline of Pittsburgh. When Audrey Burleson and her family moved into their $475,000 five-bedroom home in Chatham County's The Parks at Meadowview community in 2011, she says they knew the risk. Construction of new homes at the 793-acre development had halted 3 years earlier. Plans for the parks had included 576 home sites when completed, and only 11 homes had been built so far. But construction could soon start again at the parks at Meadowview, as well as at the 588-acre Hidden Lake community near Youngsville that also was shelved during the residential downturn. The original developer of the gated communities, Crescent Communities of Charlotte, recently finalized the sale of both properties. In 2007, when both communities were ramping up, custom homes in the parks at Meadowview were starting in the $500,000, with individual home sites selling from the $100,000. Custom homes at Hidden Lake were listed as starting at $900,000, and individual home sites were selling from the low $200,000. The Chatham County site for the Parks at Meadowview, which connects into the Chapel Ridge Golf Community, has been sold for nearly $5.4 million to Pittenger Land Investments Incorporated of Charlotte. Pittenger Land is the real estate investment firm owned and managed by the family of U.S. Representative Robert Pittenger. The Franklin County site for Hidden Lake was sold for $3.4 million to a Raleigh investor group led by the owners of the custom home building group Ang Signature Homes and Linda Leith of Leith Auto Group, according to county records. Todd Mansfield, president and CEO of Crescent Communities, says that after Crescent came out of Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in 2010, company leaders decided to focus only on the best locations in the region. We had a handful of assets, legacy assets, that we decided to part ways with, and we've sold many of them over the last 3 years. Crescent is retaining ownership of the 650-acre Retreat on Haw River property in northern Chatham County and continues to look for new development opportunities, but sources say the company was too deep in the hole financially to want to return to any of the properties. It's estimated that Crescent spent about $30 million on the construction of roads, parks, and other infrastructure at the parks at Meadowview before pulling the plug on the project in 2008. The company also invested millions into the development of Hidden Lake, which already has a lake house amenity center, boathouse, and outdoor pavilion along the shores of its 75-acre private lake. About 10 homes were built at Hidden Lake out of the 124 proposed home sites. Scott Hammerbacher, Franklin County's planning director, says he has had some preliminary discussions with the engineers representing the new owners of Hidden Lake, but no new site plan for the property has been filed. I'd love to see that community turned around and be viable again, he says. Burleson at the parks at Meadowview says the new development owners haven't reached out to meet the current residents yet, but she's hopeful that future development will keep with the high standards that Crescent had set for the community. It's a nice place to be right now, and I hope it will continue to be, she says. Barry Bowling of CBRE Raleigh represented Crescent Communities in its sale of the parks at Meadowview, and Justin Good of Cassidy Turley in Raleigh represented Crescent in the sale of Hidden Lake. And now we move down the front page to our cover story. And this cover story has the bold headline, Soccer Capital, Second Largest League in Nation Produces Millions in Tourism Revenue. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Raleigh. Sports are indisputably big business. The NFL alone generates a combined $9 billion in annual revenue. That youth sports are also big business, however, might be a little more surprising. Take, for example, the Capital Area Soccer League, more commonly known by its acronym CASEL, pronounced CASEL. This year, it has budgeted revenue of $7 million and will see roughly 9,000 soccer players come through its system of 550 teams. It is technically incorporated as a nonprofit, but really acts more like a business, says Charlie Slagle, the club's top executive. In fact, he compares it to college athletic departments without the budget for scholarships. The club's reach is not limited to the thousands of participating players and families, but to the Wake County economy as a whole. Every year, it hosts four major youth tournaments in November. This year, the tournaments will draw between 17,000 and 18,000 players, which translates to an economic impact of $9 million to Wake County, according to Scott Dupree, executive director of the Greater Raleigh Sports Alliance, which partners with Castle in the tournaments that carry the official title of Castle VisitRaleigh.com National Soccer Series. That $9 million figure is only the estimated direct visitor spending and doesn't factor in an economic multiplier that some economists use to demonstrate indirect impact. This year, the tournaments will bring close to 1,200 teams that will occupy between 25,000 and 30,000 hotel room nights, which for this market is massive, Dupree says. The Sports Alliance estimates two additional family members per athlete, meaning Wake County could see an influx of as many as 54,000 people over the four weekends, which are actually spread out over 5 weeks because there are no tournaments on the weekend following Thanksgiving. Some players only bring one parent, of course, or even double up in a situation in which one player carpools with another family. However, other players will bring extended family members, which is why Dupree uses that estimated ratio and even considers it conservative. By that estimate, each person would have to spend $167 during the weekend in town, not an unlikely figure considering it includes the price of the hotel room and meals. I think those numbers are conservative, Dupree says. Soccer as a tourism force. While he didn't know how these weekends stacked up against other major tourist weekends in Raleigh, the wide-open Bluegrass Festival, for example, Dupree says it's far and away the largest sporting event in the Triangle. When the Carolina Hurricanes hosted the NHL All-Star Game, for example, Dupree's office estimated an economic impact in the $12 million range. There are no meetings or conventions in this market that approach 25,000 to 30,000 room nights, he says. Summit Hospitality, which operates 9 going on 10 facilities in the Triangle, knows the impact of the tournament firsthand. Paul Warren, area director of sales, says the tournaments absolutely have a noticeable impact. In addition, November can be a downtime for the hospitality industry, making the impact that much better. Summit works with partners In Team Travel, which helps arrange hotel rooms for teams traveling to various tournaments. Summit will offer a tournament rate and try to work with teams every year to see their business return to a hotel they like. Although Summit competes with other hotels in the market, Warren says a major influx of people benefits all hotels. Even if one hotel doesn't see as much tournament business, it will see a spike in room nights simply from other travelers not being able to easily find a room. Indeed, that scenario happened to many of the Summit hotels during the Bluegrass Festival. Because Summit doesn't have as many hotels near downtown Raleigh, it didn't experience a major boon from that event directly. Still, it did see a spike in room nights from others who couldn't find rooms in hotels closer to downtown Raleigh. A high tide raises all boats mentality. Unusual growth. Castle hasn't always been the massive club that it is today. In fact, as recently as 2008, its revenues were just slightly more than half of what they are this year. As recently as the late 1990s, players could still choose which team they wanted to play for instead of the tryout system commonly used in clubs throughout the nation. The club, founded 40 years ago, has age and experience behind it. At the time, a group of parents decided they wanted a soccer club for their children and so formed Castle. For years, it was operated largely from the board level, which was made up mostly of parents. It grew slowly through the 1990s, but wasn't until Slagle came on board in 2001 that it began the transformation to a nationally ranked sports league. The colleges obviously helped, Slagle says, referring to soccer programs from the universities in the Triangle, which most years are considered at least fringe contenders. The UNC Chapel Hill men's team advanced to the College Cup 4 consecutive years from 2008 through 2011, college soccer's equivalent of the Final Four, and won the NCAA title in 2001 and 2011. The women's side is even more impressive. The Lady Tar Heels have amassed 21 championships since 1982 and placed second three other times. Since 2003, the Wake Med Soccer Park, formerly called the SAS Soccer Park, hosted either the men's or women's College Cup nine times. The Cup coincides with the Castle Youth Tournament, and Castle sells 16 tickets per team as part of the registration packet. Teams are charged a $995 registration fee or $1,295 fee for the tournament that plays the same weekend as the College Cup. If the Women's Cup is in town, Castle schedules its girls' tournament for that weekend. If the men are in town, it schedules the boys' tournament that weekend. For its regular operating budget, player registration fees account for the majority, about 44%, of Castle's revenue. About 23% comes from training fees and another 19% from tournaments. The remainder is generated through line items including camps or clinics and tryout fees. On the expense side, about 36% goes towards salaries, or 44% when insurance and workers' compensation are included. Slagle received a $150,000 salary in 2012. Of the remaining expenses, no single item takes a large chunk, with items like renting and maintaining fields, paying referees and buying uniforms, or paying association dues all playing a factor. Club track versus high school soccer. In terms of the offerings, Castle considers itself a full-service club, meaning it offers a team for a player at any skill level up to age 18. Not many clubs around the nation have such a wide array of teams from which to choose. Many clubs will specialize either in top-tier teams being groomed for advancement or purely recreational leagues. Castle has decided to offer both. At the top level is the U.S. Soccer Federation Development Academy, or simply the Academy for short. These teams play 10 months out of the year and are linked with a professional club, the Carolina Railhawks, in Castle's case. There are only 80 such teams around the nation, and they exclusively play each other, not other teams. The idea is to get the best players in the area, Slagle says. The program mirrors what many European countries have and is still relatively new in the United States. It is intended to be a pipeline not only to top college programs, but a way for the U.S. national team to find and develop the very best players. The academy has not come without criticism, however. For example, players may not play for their high school teams, forcing 16-year-olds into a tough decision. Mike Watala covers youth soccer for Soccer America and laments that the academy is going in this direction. I think the worst part about club versus high school is the situation that it puts kids into, he says. It forces them to decide between things they enjoy very much. High school sports is a big part of a kid's social life. Parents often voice the same concerns. Waitala says that for the small minority who earn scholarships and even play professionally, the academy is likely a good scenario. But for the majority of players who will not move on to the next level, he wonders if they will have missed out. I don't know how many of those kids will end up regretting it, he says. They might feel like they missed out on something. It's really a difficult issue. I kind of wish they had left it to the clubs to decide. Soccer in his blood. A significant amount of Castle's growth is due to Slagle's leadership. Slagle was recruited by Davidson College to play football, but after a disagreement with his coach over his position, he moved to the soccer team as goalkeeper. After graduation, he was asked by Davidson to return as the head soccer coach. He coached 450 games, including a run to the College Cup in 1992 that earned him the National Coach of the Year award. He has been helped coordinate the College Cup a dozen times and is working to bring it back to Cary, an event the town lost after it didn't make NCAA-requested renovations to the stadium. On Saturday mornings at 8 a.m., you can hear Slagle on 99.9 The Fan hosting a soccer-dedicated radio show. And also there's a short section along with this article titled Players to Come Out of Castle. Castle routinely graduates players who play college soccer, many of which play for Division I and Atlantic Coast Conference schools. Some players have even gone on to successful professional careers. Here are two examples. Logan Paws, a Hillsboro native, Paws played high school soccer at Jordan High School in Durham and was a member of the North Carolina Olympic Development Program from 1993 through 1999, before going to UNC Chapel Hill and becoming a co-captain. As a freshman in Chapel Hill, he started 20 games, and by 2002, he was named first-team All-ACC. In 2001, he helped UNC Chapel Hill win the College Cup, the first in school history. In 2003, he was drafted 24th overall by the Chicago Fire and is in his 11th season with the team, making him the longest tenured player on the squad. He has appeared in 272 games and started 247 of those, and is now in his third year as team captain. In his career, he has averaged playing in more than 25 games and 2,053 minutes per season. In February 2004, Paws appeared in four of the U.S. Under-23's five matches in the 2004 CONCACAF Olympic Qualifying Tournament in Guadalajara, Mexico, helping the side to the semifinals. And also, Michael Harrington. After playing for Castle, Harrington played 82 games for UNC Chapel Hill from 2003 through 2006, where he scored 4 goals and assisted on 14 others. He played on teams that made 4 consecutive NCAA tournament appearances. He was named to the ACC All-Freshman team and selected to the first-team All-ACC, and was named to the preseason Herman Trophy watch list prior to his senior season in 2006. Harrington was selected number 3 overall by Sporting KC in the 2007 MLS Super Draft and won the club's Rookie of the Year award after appearing in 29 regular season matches. He even scored his first MLS goal 3 minutes into his first career MLS start. He now plays for the Portland Timbers, where he has started in 28 of the club's 29 regular season matches. He is the club's current leader in minutes played with 2,501 this season and one of 6 Portland players on the fan ballot for the 2013 AT&T MLS All-Star Game. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. PNC exec shares leadership secrets. Paula Freiland, regional president for PNC Bank, shared insights and war stories with attendees of TBJ's Power Breakfast last week. In her opening remarks, Freiland noted that several years ago, she hired a career coach to help her work on certain issues she felt might be keeping her from reaching her goals. During the audience Q&A, she was asked to identify the specific problem she was addressing with the coach. "I wasn't getting my way," Freiland replied. That sort of honesty made for a lively session during which Freiland delivered several gems on liberal arts degrees. "The banking industry is looking at these candidates again. You can teach the technical skills, but communication and critical thinking are much harder to come by." On work-life balance, "It's a myth to think you can do it all." On her favorite app, ESPN Fantasy Football. Seasoned manager to lead team at Rival Inn. Jack Schmidt, general manager of the Carolina Inn Hotel on UNC Chapel Hill's campus, has left the historic property to take a management-level position at the rival Washington Duke Inn and Golf Club on Duke University's campus in Durham. But Schmidt says it has nothing to do with a rivalry or about his time at the Carolina Inn. His decision to join the Washington Duke as its new director of sales and marketing was more about the people than the place, and what will probably be his last stop on the tour on a 30-plus year career in hospitality. Wall Street, meet these surgical robots. Joe Slattery soon starts his new position as CFO at TransEnterix, literally moving across the triangle from Boxano Surgical, formerly known as Trans One, where he held the same role. Why? Robots, of course. "I have done everything," he says, referencing a career in diagnostics, biotech, medical devices. "But robots? That's a new one." "Having a robotic angle, that's pretty interesting," he says. TransEnterix is developing a robotic surgical platform, and Slattery's job will be to introduce it to Wall Street. With TransEnterix's merger with Safe Stitch Medical, the company is officially trading. The challenge? Getting Wall Street more aware of the company and what the opportunity is there, he says. Pest company brings smiles to teachers. Clegg's Termite and Pest Control helped fill a school bus with $54,000 in supplies for Durham area teachers The annual drive is held by Crayon to Calculators and the Durham Teacher Warehouse Corporation. Donations are stored in the group's warehouse, where teachers are invited to shop for their classrooms at no charge. This is helpful to teachers who sometimes spend their own money on school supplies to give their students the best learning experience. Indeed, a recent study by the National School Supply and Equipment Association found that in the 2012 to 2013 school year, 99.5% of public school teachers reported spending their own money on school supplies. 10% spent $1,000 or more of their own money in total for the school year, about double the percent as in past studies. Clegg's has 290 employees. Local CEO selected as VIP entrepreneur. If you don't know about the Khan Academy, you should. The nonprofit is intent on providing free education to everyone across the world through its online educational curriculum. And recently, it invited a CEO from the Triangle to be on an inaugural entrepreneurship series with the likes of Richard Branson of Virgin Atlantic, Elon Musk of Tesla Motors, and Mark Echo, founder of Echo Unlimited. Giles Shi, CEO of Durham's BioResource International, tells Biz he was elated to be part of the series. It really happened because the Khan Academy series sponsor, Kauffman Foundation, contacted me during my visit to the Inc. 500 event in Arizona last year, she says. They taped me for an hour, and I almost forgot about it. BioResource is an agrobiotech company that is researching the animal feed enzymes. The company has $10 million in revenue. What was cool about the Khan Academy Kauffman video was the way they presented my story through animations and graphics, she says. They made it a simpler story. Contributing to Biz were staffers Jason DeBrun, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, and Lauren Onsorge. And now we continue with the full-length story in the Triangle Business Journal. The headline on this next article, Life-Saving Test Needs a Better Pitch. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with the Dateline of Raleigh. Bob Gretchen has his work cut out for him. The former CEO of Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, Gretchen has been charged with transforming Raleigh-based LipoScience from an IPO dud to a thriving stock on the NASDAQ. In a lot of ways, this is almost like going back to your roots, he says, of the interim role, but adds, leadership is leadership. The 240-employee company creates personalized diagnostics, including tests that measure the low-density lipoprotein particles in a blood sample. LipoScience strikes a special chord with Gretchen, and not just because he's served on the board for 2 years. Gretchen himself is a patient whose cholesterol levels make LipoScience tests relevant. While his old-style LDL cholesterol levels are fairly normal, his particular levels, a newer diagnostic reading that LipoScience delivers, are high. The more particles you have in your blood, the more they interact with your arteries, he explains, adding that a test that might one day save his life could bear the LipoScience brand. I've seen the impact, he says. But the public market isn't convinced, and that's the rub for LipoScience. After a so-so first public quarter, LipoScience had two disappointing back-to-back earnings reports. The company faced another challenge in August with the resignation of longtime CEO Richard Breyer, who had pushed LipoScience into the public sphere. Piper Jaffray analyst Bill Quirk was surprised at the time, but not in retrospect. They made the CEO announcement at the same time they were talking about the second quarter earnings, he notes, referencing to the latest quarter, which saw $13.3 million in total revenue, a year-over-year decline of 4.3%. The challenge began well before Gretchen's appointment. LipoScience has been transitioning from conducting tests in-house to providing testing equipment to hospital labs and other facilities, but adoption has been slow, and analysts have fingered the sales team as a possible culprit. In the first quarter, the sales team was 20% larger year-over-year, but the volume increased only 9%, a fact analysts grilled Breyer on in an earnings call. He blamed experienced sales representatives having new roles and replacements that weren't yet up to par. Those new reps didn't get the degree of, if you will, coaching that they normally would get coming straight out of training, Breyer said at the time. Another challenge Gretchen may need to address is payer and physician adoption. Not every plan is keen on financing the tests, and that's a challenge. It's probably going to take some time to get the business realigned to try to convert some of those healthcare plans, Quirk says. But the stock market is impatient. We continue to meet frequently with payers to update them on recent publications and changes in guidelines and recommendations from professional medical societies with an objective of achieving more widespread coverage for the test, Gretchen says. That could be where the new leader comes in. Quirk says he'd like to see someone with experience in managed care. For LipoScience, the gamble is bigger than a public market reputation. CFO Lucy Martindale says the company just renewed a 10-year lease and is completing renovations that include a cafeteria revamp. We're in it for the long haul, she says. And now we turn to the section in Triangle Business Journal called A Better World, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. And first we have the column by Todd Cohen. The headline on the column, Dispute Settlement Center Works to Help Resolve Differences. The Dispute Settlement Center in Carrboro was providing mediation services for 400 to 500 people referred each year by criminal district courts. When state lawmakers in 2011 eliminated $1.2 million in funding for roughly 20 mediation centers throughout the state. Lawmakers left it to people in criminal courts who opt to resolve their disputes through mediation to pay for those services themselves, a move that mainly affected people with limited resources and created a bottleneck in the courts, says Francis Henderson, executive director of the center. The burden on district court already was immense, she says. But after a year with no local criminal court mediation, the Orange County Board of Commissioners agreed to revive the program, providing the center with $60,000 in funding effective July 1, 2012. Founded in 1978 by citizens concerned about court crowding and about how disputes were resolved in court, the center was the state's first community mediation program. It operates with 6 employees and an annual budget of $425,000 and counts on fees for 47% of its funds, government for 29%, and private support for 24%. The center serves about 3,000 people per year, providing roughly 800 mediations. In addition to handling mediations for people referred by criminal court, the center handles disputes referred by the State Office of Administrative Hearings over the denial of requested Medicaid services or referred by the State Department of Public Instruction when parents have problems with individual education plans prepared by schools for children in special education programs. The center also handles mediations and conflicts between spouses and domestic partners, parents and children, neighbors, and neighborhoods and local government on issues such as planning and the environment. And it provides training on conflict resolution and mediation for employers and organizations, as well as individuals, including those looking for professional development opportunities. Henderson says that while more people today than in the past understand what mediation is, they still can be reluctant to use it to settle disputes. It can be tough to get people to the mediation table, she says. We've talked to countless people who want mediation, but we can't get the other party to the table. Compounding that reluctance is pent-up demand, she says. People during the downturn worked so hard, maybe worked a job and a half, and a lot of conflict was created, she says. So now, as the economy is getting a little better, people are saying, let's deal with the conflict we've got. The graying of the population also is creating a lot of potential for conflict within families about aging parents, particularly those living with their children, with issues ranging from the need to write wills and estate plans to whether the parents should be living in retirement homes. People know those issues are coming, but families don't tend to have the conversations they need to have in planning, Henderson says. It's also emotionally charged, and it's better to have the conversation sooner to preserve the relationships. And also on this page, we have a nonprofit Q&A featuring Jeff Corbett, who is Senior Vice President, Carolina's Delivery Operations, Duke Energy, newly elected chair of the Board of Trustees for the North Carolina Symphony. Elected chair in September, Corbett has served on the board since 2008. As the newly elected chair, what are your goals for the symphony? A very thought-out strategy that the Board of Trustees has created to guide us through 2017. We are continuing to focus on the quality and effectiveness of the orchestra. Progress Energy was a huge part of the Triangle Arts community. With the merger, do you see Duke Energy doing similar community outreach? There are a lot of things Progress Energy and Duke Energy had in common. One of them was the support in the art institutions that really make a difference. What do you think the future will hold for the symphony and arts in the Triangle? With some of the latest events here in Raleigh, Wide Open Bluegrass, Hopscotch, and SparkCon, that have drawn in thousands of fans, the impact of art in the Triangle can only go up. I think that's indicative of a community that's serious about what art brings to this place we're proud of. Any last words? The Symphony is really expanding its mission in terms of introducing kids to all kinds of art. You never know what's going to spark a young person. And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal. First, we start with the page for Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. And the main article on this page is under a heading of The Take, Top 5 Ways to Lose Your Real Estate License. Mortgage fraud, embezzlement, lying. Pamela Vesper saw it all in the 14 years she spent as a prosecutor, auditor, and investigator for the North Carolina Real Estate Commission. Vesper left the commission in July to pursue a career in teaching real estate law. She is now a licensing and continuing education instructor with Superior School of Real Estate, and we asked her about the best advice she would give a real estate broker or agent now that she's on the teaching side. Here are the top 5 pitfalls she says that a real estate agent should stay away from to avoid losing his or her real estate license. Take your eye off the money. Even if you love and trust your bookkeeper, love, trust, and verify, Vesper says. If you're not up to supervising the person who is handling your trust accounts, then don't take the money. Let the other side of the transaction hold the money or give it to the closing attorney. The broker in charge is responsible for everything in the office. Failure to disclose material facts. There was this case about a new development coming online, and the real estate agents were telling the prospective purchasers that this lot abutting the property was a wetland and would never be built on. Of course, they were all thrilled and all the lots sold. About 6 months later, they wake up and all the trees are gone. It was not really a wetland, only part of it was a wetland, and they were building an apartment complex behind that land. A lot of real estate agents got in trouble for that one. Handling your agency improperly. An agent can either be a buyer's agent, seller's agent, or a dual agent. Make sure you understand on whose behalf you are acting. If it is a dual agent situation, make sure everybody understands and everybody is on board and get all agency agreements in writing. Assisting clients with creative financing. We had a case where the buyers couldn't qualify for a mortgage, so the real estate agent had his wife write bogus employment letters saying they worked for her so these people could qualify for these loans. He said he was just helping them achieve the American dream. Of course, they couldn't really afford those loans, and it ended up going to foreclosure. That's a felony. Mortgage fraud is illegal. And don't pay your annual renewal fee for your real estate license. It expires immediately if you don't pay, and it's annual. Take your continuing education and keep your license current. And we have another section titled On the Move. LexisNexis will be moving and expanding the headquarters for its Business of Law Software Solutions Division from Regency Park in Cary to the 1801 Varsity Drive building at NC State University's Centennial Campus beginning in early 2014. Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin and other pain relief medications, will build a $59 million production plant at Trayburn Corporate Park in northern Durham County that will employ 100 people. Anthropologie, the popular women's apparel brand, is opening its second store location in the Triangle at North Hills in Raleigh. The Raleigh store should open by the spring. Mercury Gate, a transportation management firm, has signed a lease for 28,234 square feet at 200 Regency Forest Drive in Cary, which will be nearly triple the size of the office it's vacating at 100 Regency Forest Drive in Cary. And Occam Development, a contract research organization, is relocating and expanding into 19,765 square feet at the Center Green 2 office building in Cary from the 8,000 Regency Park building in Cary. And we have one final short article on this page titled, Strumming for Dollars in Raleigh. I've been to a lot of cities, but I've never seen anything like this. Irene Peterson, director of sales and marketing for the Raleigh Marriott City Center Hotel, after playing host to hundreds of bluegrass musicians in Raleigh for the International Bluegrass Music Association's annual business conference, music awards show, and festival held September 24 through 28. The 17-story Marriott Hotel sold out all 400 of its guest rooms for at least three or four nights, she says, and came close to selling out the rest of the week. The hotel designated four floors for jamming sessions and set up stages for practice sessions. Raleigh tourism officials were expecting the event to have a more than $5 million local economic impact on the city. And now we turn to the page of Jason DeBrun. DeBrun covers healthcare, higher education, and sports business. And the article on his page has the headline, UNC Partners with India. The University of North Carolina system is developing a strategy to recruit students from India. While the community has a population of poor citizens that outnumbers the entire population of the United States, living alongside that population is a fast-growing middle class. In the next two decades, India will need to educate more than a half billion people under the age of 25 in order to continue growing and deliver on the promise of a rising democracy. As India prospers economically and its population grows, it needs world-class education, says Hari Nath, a member of the UNC Board of Governors who immigrated from India to the United States almost 50 years ago. At the same time, because India is becoming more important economically, people in the U.S. need to learn more about India. The environment today is pregnant for partnership through student and faculty exchange, research, and collaboration, he says. Nath and UNC System President Tom Ross recently joined others from business and higher education for the first ever UNC India Summit in Chapel Hill, which included representatives from the Indian government. If we are going to be successful as a state in the 21st century, Ross said in his opening remarks, North Carolinians must better understand the largest democracy in the world. Essentially, the university leaders want to make even better connections in India. UNC campuses have more than 40 official partnerships with Indian counterparts, and faculty members collaborate with Indian colleagues on scholarly papers and research projects. More than 1,500 Indian students attend UNC institutions, and various campuses have study abroad programs available in India. Still, the study abroad programs send only a fraction of all foreign study students to India. Of the 5,793 students who studied abroad in the 2010 to 2011 school year, only 99 or fewer than 2% went to India. UNC leaders see an economic opportunity for North Carolina coming out of India and want to position its graduates in a place where they will be able to best take advantage of a growing economy that is projected to see 400 million people raised out of poverty and build as many as 1,000 new universities in the coming years. And now we have the reporter page of Lauren Onsorge. Onsorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. And the first headline we have on her page is LexisNexis hot on Raleigh. LexisNexis announced it's moving its business of law software solutions division to Centennial Campus from Cary. Mike Lips, Vice President and Managing Director of the LexisNexis Business of Law Software Solutions, says it wasn't Cary versus Raleigh. It was downtown versus Centennial Campus. You certainly get the sense that Raleigh in general is becoming a growing tech hub, he says. But university partnership opportunities at North Carolina State University were what really nailed the decision. NC State isn't part of downtown Raleigh, but it's pretty darn close, and maybe we'll have better access to parking. He hopes that, by housing his employees in the same office where Red Hat found its Raleigh legs, he'll have better access to talent and a real shot at brand buzz. The reality is, when you think of top-tier technology companies in the Triangle, you think of your Red Hats and your SAS and your Lenovo and IBM, he says. At the end of the day, that's what we aspire to be, one of those companies that rolls off your tongue in that top tier of companies. But if you're looking for a job, you don't have to wait on the new digs. 27 jobs are currently open, and the majority of those are tech-heavy and in the $90,000 range. The headcount, which was 120 when the agreement was signed in 2012, is 245 today and climbing. And in another short article has the headline, Want Cash? Don't Commit These Three Sins. Want to turn off investors and make sure they don't hound you with any of their pesky cash coffers? Merritt Moore, Managing Director for Raleigh-based investors Lookout Capital, has some advice just for you on what to not do and how to avoid those things. 1. Be a know-it-all. They try to come off as knowing more than they do, he says, adding that if you want to make a successful pitch, mention the risks and shortcomings. The folks that come in and tell you everything is all great and perfect and all puppy dogs and sunshine, those pitches don't go over very well with us. 2. Don't put thought into your business model. People come in with financial models that are very ill-conceived and are not very well thought out, he says, adding that's a surefire way to turn off an investor. I like to understand and be comfortable with the fact that they've put a lot of thought into what the numbers could be. 3. Underestimate the sales process. A lot of these folks, particularly the technology guys, they are engineers and they are techies who understand the product side, the technology side, but have little understanding of how to sell something. And the last short article on this page, headlined, Regado, R-E-G-A-D-O, cuts Durham staff after stock surge. New Jersey-based Duke University spinoff Regado Biosciences is laying off 15% of its staff, and according to a securities filing, its Durham headcount will see the bulk of those cuts. The move comes a month after the firm went public, raising a slashed $47 million on NASDAQ. The firm says the decision is about focusing on its lead candidate, a blood clotting treatment, and adds that it will save about $625,000 per year. The 13 employees remaining at the Durham lab work in roles that directly support the therapy's ongoing Phase 3 study, says a company spokesperson. The news comes about a week after the company's first real stock bump. And now we turn to the Spotlight article in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal. And the Spotlight is on sports business. The headline, Fans Engage on Multiple Platforms. And this article is written by David Broughton with a Dateline of Charlotte. More than half of avid fans who use social media to follow sports now do so while watching their favorite team's games, according to the 2013 Sports Fan Engagement Study conducted by Catalyst on behalf of Sports Business Journal. This is the fourth consecutive year Catalyst has conducted a survey of this type. It's the first time in-game engagement marks have surpassed 50%. Fans' use of Facebook and Twitter specifically during the game has increased by about 10 percentage points over the past year and by 15 percentage points compared with 2011. Pre-game use on the two sites saw a 10-point jump compared with last year, while post-game activity surged 15 points. Facebook-owned Instagram saw even bigger gains. YouTube, however, saw an overall decline in game day activity. Digital engagement and sports is now a social norm, says Brett Werner, Catalyst Senior Vice President and Managing Director. Pre, during, or post-game, the sports fan has a variety of digital channels to engage in conversation. Social media allows for the game to never end. Facebook remains the most used social networking site among U.S. avid sports fans and with Americans in general. 73% of the survey's 2,101 avid fans have a Facebook account and use it in relation to sports. That total is down 8 percentage points from 2012, but is still higher than a Pew Research Center report released last month that indicated that 67% of Americans are Facebook users. The percentage of fans who have a Google Plus and or YouTube account increased significantly over the last year. According to the research, social media is used as a primary source of sports information more often than newspapers, radio, and magazines. Only TV and non-social media websites are viewed as more trustworthy sources. Additionally, young fans are the most likely fans of any age group to use social networking in some way to stay connected with their favorite teams or athletes. The study also reveals that Hispanics are 1.2 times more likely than the average sports fan to use Google+. Looking across the leagues, although a survey high 78% of NFL fans use Facebook in some way to follow the league, those fans are the least likely to use any of the other popular social media sites. NBA and soccer fans, on the other hand, are twice as likely as NFL fans to use Instagram. About one quarter of NBA fans and soccer fans said they will view and or respond to content created by a non-sports brand that was linked in some way to their favorite sports. That response rate is higher than the rate posted by any other measured group. College basketball fans at 20%, MLB, NFL, and college football fans all at 16%. Overall, two-thirds of fans say they have liked a brand on Facebook and half say they have followed a brand on Twitter based on having seen a particular brand's promotion during a sporting event or broadcast. More importantly to marketers, one-third of these fans said they purchased or used the brand's service after connecting with the brand via the sports platform. Soccer fans were the most receptive to such opportunities, with 72% of that sports respondent saying they've taken such steps through Facebook and 60% via Twitter. But fans across sports say it is still a fine line. More than half indicated that they had unliked or unfollowed a brand because the company was either posting, tweeting too often, or was sending irrelevant information. Sports fans are willing to take an action that has business impact, such as making purchases or recommendations, Werner said. Brands need to earn their right to be part of the community by having the right dialogue, offerings, and content to engage them, or fans are more likely than ever to disengage. The fan is smart enough to know when a brand is not part of the authentic sports conversation. This year's survey was for the first time replicated in the UK and Brazil during the same time period, targeting exclusively avid soccer fans in those two regions. Full results from those studies were not available as of press time, but according to Catalyst, results that have been compiled indicate that Facebook and Twitter use among soccer fans in the UK was almost identical to the use by their US counterparts. However, US fans were far more likely to use YouTube, Google Plus, and Instagram than UK-based fans. And this edition of the Triangle Business Journal also includes the 2013 Best Places to Work list. First, we'll read how the firms were selected. Since 2004, the Best Places to Work selection process has been based on confidential surveys answered by employees of the nominated companies. This year, 101 companies registered for the program by sending their contact information to Triangle Business Journal. TBJ then forwarded this information to our partner, Quantum Workplace, a company that conducts employee engagement surveys. Quantum Workplace contacted each company and provided instructions for accessing the confidential online employee survey. The contact person at each company was responsible for encouraging employees to complete the survey. Nominees were required to meet a threshold in employee participation, a percentage that varies based upon the size of the company, to be eligible to be honored. Once the survey period was over, Quantum tallied up the scores and sent the final numbers to Triangle Business Journal. This year, Triangle Business Journal is honoring 35 companies, those that scored in the top 10 of the three size categories, and the top 5 in the giant category. The first, second, and third place winners in each size category receive a free employee engagement report from Quantum Workplace. Other companies that participated can purchase a report at a reduced cost. And the categories are small, 10 to 50 employees, medium, 51 to 150 employees, Large, 151 to 999 employees, and Giant, 1,000 employees and up. And in the Giant Company category, number one goes to NetApp. Description, storage and data management solutions. Number of full-time employees in the triangle, 1,621. Top Triangle Executive and Title, Rich Clifton, Senior Vice President of Customer Success Operations. What are some unique characteristics of your company's approach to human resources? Employees often tell us that part of why they love working at NetApp is that they are treated as a full member of the team, where they are expected to come to the table with their opinion. We are committed to creating a healthy work environment and making this a great place to work by living our values and embracing strong principles. NetApp's company culture is defined by our core values: trust and integrity, leadership, simplicity, adaptability, teamwork, and synergy, and going beyond to get things done. When new employees arrive at NetApp, we strive to create an environment in which employees are proud of their work, enjoy working with their colleagues, and trust the leadership. This helps make all employees feel part of the team, creating a sense of unity and camaraderie. How do you communicate your company's mission and vision so that each employee feels part of the firm's future? We make it a priority to keep everyone informed about all the important aspects of the company. By design, nearly all employees, including senior executives, sit in cubicles, and any employee can schedule a face-to-face meeting with any executive. President and CEO Tom Gorgens is very clear: employees should speak their minds and uphold our culture of transparency. And in large companies, the winner is Coldwell Banker Advantage. Description: residential real estate firm. Number of full-time employees in the triangle, 315. Top Triangle Executive in Title, Gary Raybon, President and CEO. What are some unique characteristics of your company's approach to human resources? We are very selective in hiring and careful that each person is a good match for our company. It's easy to grow employee agent numbers indiscriminately, but that's not the best approach for long-term success. And in the medium companies category, the winner is Hill, Chesson, and Woody. Description: employee benefits consulting firm. Number of full-time employees in the triangle, 65. And Top Triangle Executive in Title, Todd Yates, Managing Partner. And finally, in the small companies, the winner is Automated Insights Incorporated. Description: producer and publisher of personalized user content at scale. Number of full-time employees in the triangle, 16. Top Triangle Executive and Title, Robbie Allen, CEO. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Triangle researchers, DOT employees furloughed amid government shutdown. In the absence of government funds, more than 1,000 employees at the National Institute of Health and Environmental Sciences Raleigh headquarters will be taking an unwanted vacation. A federal government shutdown has led to the furloughing of 1,277 workers, with just 93 remaining to protect the life of patients, research animals, and maintain equipment safety at the NIEHS, one of 27 research institutes that comprise the National Institute of Health under the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. At the North Carolina Department of Transportation, 22 of the 65 full-time employees that are federally funded have been furloughed. The department is still unsure about the impact the federal shutdown will have on any public transportation projects that require input or approval from furloughed federal employees. That could impact any state projects that require federal permits and work supported by federal agencies. Triangle jobless rate drops to 6.8%. Unemployment rates dropped in 98 out of the 100 North Carolina counties in August. The Triangle's overall jobless rate in August dropped 0.7% to rest at 6.8%, one of the lowest in recent years. Merck to slash workforce by 8,500. Triangle ops to be impacted. Merck & Company, the second largest U.S. drug maker by sales, is cutting 8,500 workers and restructuring its research and development, a move that will impact Triangle operations. Merck spokesperson Chesney Johnson confirms workforce reductions are occurring throughout the company's global workforce. Merck had a total of 1,400 employees in the Triangle last year, according to Triangle Business Journal research. Investor pays $19 million for Bayer Crop Science building near RTP. California real estate investor Alexandria Real Estate Equities has purchased another building near Research Triangle Park as an extension of its relationship with Bayer Crop Science. Paying $19.4 million for an 82,000-square-foot laboratory office building at 407 Davis Drive in Durham, according to Durham County records. It is the same building that Bayer Crop Science signed a lease deal to occupy in January as the company prepares for a major renovation and redevelopment of its headquarters campus in Research Triangle Park. Bayer Crop Science plans to occupy the entire building at Keystone Technology Park, which Wyeth Pharmaceuticals vacated 2 years prior to the lease deal. WakeMed taps Vincel to scout for Atkinson's replacement. WakeMed Health and Hospitals will bring on Doug Vincel to help find a replacement for Bill Atkinson. Vincel retired as CEO of Duke Raleigh Hospital last year after helming that ship for 6 years. Prior to moving there, he worked as chief operating officer at WakeMed. Atkinson and WakeMed parted ways last week, citing differences in the future direction of the organization. The WakeMed board also approved a severance package for Atkinson on Tuesday, but did not release details about that contract. Vincel will first help advise the interim leadership team already in place, led by Chief Operating Officer Tom Gettinger. A pay package has not yet been decided for Vincel. And quickly, we have last week's poll results. The question was, if you had to choose, would you buy health insurance through the exchange, ACA, or pay the penalty? 63% said they would buy the health insurance through the exchange, 27% said they would pay the penalty, and 10% say that they would do neither. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.